the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys.
Over here on my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hey, Mike.
And next to Andrew, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
And we are Brit-free in the podcast today.
Brit-free.
it's more of an immigration policy than anything else.
That's right. I think they had to go back home, but hopefully they'll be back soon. But yeah, Bobby Martin couldn't make it. But I'm glad you guys are here. And joining us, we've got Justin Brandstanner.
How you doing?
And we've got his buddy, Hez McMurray.
Hey, how you doing?
And let me just tell you right off the bat, these guys aren't audio guys at all.
What?
No.
They're very smart.
I just deal with pictures.
That's right. They're working. Actually, they're visual effects artists. Justin, you are a matte painter?
Yeah, digital environments, yeah.
Digital environments. It's changed so much.
Yeah, they kind of it's morphed so much now that it's generally referred to as, you know, digital environments. So it started off kind of matte painting.
You guys got computers now?
Yeah, we use computers now.
That's cool.
For which formats? Games, TV, film?
You know, the weird thing is it's kind of merging now. We've got, you know, a lot of cinematics happening with games. So you're seeing this convergence with games, you know, visual effects with, you know, live action films. A lot of the same gaming guys are starting to, you know, work more in the visual effects. So you're starting to see a convergence, the similar kind of similar looks to a lot of the shots are happening now with the cinematics, but even animation with, you know, Beowulf and these new films are becoming a lot more photorealistic look to them. So, yeah, we're seeing this kind of path, this convergence now that's happening with a lot of the environment artists, which is kind of a good thing. It's kind of pushing everybody.
So you create a really cool environment, then you defocus it?
Yeah. Exactly. We just wrap that focus. And
you're not painting on a big, giant piece of glass anymore, then.
No more glass. No.
And Hez, what do you do? You're
I'm basically like a digital cameraman.
Okay.
And we're dealing specifically with doing stereoscopic right now.
Wow.
So we're dealing with left eye, right eye, and convergence and things like that.
For 3D or for?
Yep. Yeah.
There's a lot of 3D stuff
coming
out.
That's right.
That's crazy. Well, I wanted these guys to come on mainly because I didn't have another guest this week, but
I feel so special.
No, I'm just kidding.
Awesome.
No, but I just wanted to open up the podcast. We're going to be bringing on more than audio guys onto the podcast, mainly so you can see how it all kind of fits together. And later on, we're going to be talking to Justin about, you know, when he sees some of his projects with the audio environments and how does it affect his creativity and things like that. He's worked for, both you guys work for DreamWorks right now.
Right.
And I know, you know, you've worked on like Kung Fu Panda and Over the Hedge, and your live action, it's been Time Machine and Van Helsing.
Right.
And you've done some of the classic Disney animations like Aladdin and Hunchback and
Tarzan,
through the
90s.
Yeah.
We got some matches here.
Yeah,
you guys have probably worked on a bunch of the same projects.
Never
ran into each other.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, Scott's on one end, you're on the other end.
Nice.
It's kind of funny to shake hands and then the universe explodes.
That's exactly how I would put it.
and has a list, a couple of your titles that you've worked on.
I started out way back on Dinosaur and made my way into like TV. Did a couple things there, and then got back into animation and worked on Sky Captain and
Sky Captain,
Prince of Egypt, El Dorado. You know, it's mainly been DreamWorks films. So.
DreamWorks. That's cool. Yeah. And what'd you do with Sky Captain? Were you saying like the digital cameraman? Because that was a great film.
No, actually, on that one I lit and composited, and also did a lot of work on the pipeline there and wrote a lot of code to get things done. So it was a very garage band kind of thing. So,
but that was a great movie, especially, I mean, it was all shot green screen and it just, I really liked the look. I just thought that was a fantastic movie.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, moving on to the world of audio. AES 2008.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. How many people here went?
It doesn't work. Audio only. I went.
And what did you think? I also went. So.
Was it good attendance or not by us?
Yeah, Well, yeah. I mean, it was a small show, and I haven't been in at least 5 years. So it was quite a bit smaller than the last time I went, maybe two-thirds the size.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of people there, which was good. And everybody was in pretty good spirits, which considering the world had already exploded economically at that point.
Yeah, that's amazing.
There were a lot of people there showing a lot of new gear, a lot of smaller gear, which was good, you know, like, I'm sure Mike's going to talk about some of the stuff specifically, but a lot of people showing a product, and that's what they do now, but it's really good, as opposed to trying to launch a whole line of stuff.
Wait,
is there like 5 or 10 things you can name that just made you go, ooh, ah?
No. Even before that, why don't you explain what the AES show is so that Justin's not looking quite as confused?
It's a trade show for like audio geeks. I mean, it's run by the Audio Engineering Society. So there is a side of the convention that is ridiculously technical, and it's technical papers on things that I don't even understand the titles of, let alone what it is they talk about. But it's all of the theory and the behind the electronics and the acoustics to deal with sound and all that. Then they also have a big set of panels where you can go. Like, they had a mastering panel with a bunch of mastering engineers. They had a producer's round table, things like
everything,
that.
Everything, gaming, audio, everything.
And then there's the actual trade show, which is just everybody's got booths set up and their speakers blaring and microphones. And
sounds like Seagrave.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I didn't go to that either.
So, have you ever sat in on any of the white papers? Because I actually...
Oh, they're great.
I heard just a little bit. And I'm talking audio that was on a level that I think only aliens could understand.
I've sat in on a few of those, and I agree. I mean,
but it's fun though.
I mean, I think for the equipment designers, it's amazing.
Oh yeah,
actually get together and share these ideas.
Absolutely.
And it's incredible. But you know, the boundary effect of microphone diaphragms in different humidity ranges and under tension.
That was
hot.
You know what? It just makes me want to go out and just listen to music and not think about it. By the time it's over, after you sit and listen to that stuff long enough. Yeah. Actually, though, our friend Marvin Caesar from Aphex actually gave one of those panel discussions this time to do with compression and digital versus analog compression and noise. I think it was basically based on ear fatigue and how noise affects your hearing and that kind of stuff. And he knew he was giving it to a smart audience, so he really worked on the presentation, but apparently it went really well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I saw Marvin there.
Oh, did you?
I didn't go to his panel, but...
Your head would have exploded.
But the one thing that when I hear all these just high-end, you know, white papers and on terms and things that I just can't even comprehend. It really makes me appreciate the products that come out of that. And you need people thinking on that level to really advance the technology. So,
well, and it's also been true that at a lot of those kinds of white paper meetings, somebody will announce some technology and then everybody will adopt it and do it their own way. And one of the best examples of that was someone had come out with a better way to do time compression and expansion. I don't remember who it was. But then all of a sudden, every company that made time compression software, it was just way better.
Right.
And those kinds of panels really do help for that.
Or real-time disk streaming. I remember somebody came in and said, hey, you can stream off a hard drive and play the piano.
That's right.
And at a piano demo, I remember they said, you can hit all the keys with your arm. It'll play every voice. At that time, nothing was like it.
And then
it turned into the Giga Studio.
Right. And then they got sued because it was actually someone else's idea.
Oops. Well, anyhow, so AES was kind of fun. I actually had the privilege. I was working with the API guys, and I was working in their booth, and they were showing the new Arsenal Audio, which is some really great, great audio gear that's it's another line of API gear. They're not going to change their 500 series. They can't change all the classics, but they have just some brilliant designers and engineers, and they know how to make audio. So they just started a whole nother line. And I thought that was a pretty honest way for a company to deal with introducing new product, because, you know, they could have brought out a product and called it, a 550 XB4 or 512 147. And they just said, you know what? This isn't like the classic. This is its own new thing. So let's just give it a whole new family, a whole new brand. And so it's pretty good. It sounds great. But the big thing over at AES, I think, was the announce of Pro Tools 8. Do you guys want to say anything, Andrew, about Pro Tools 8 and what you saw?
Well, sure.
I mean, wait for 801.
No. I mean, well, it looks good.
You got to wait for 8. I mean, it's the first thing is it's a bold move on their part because it's a complete redesign of the UI. Complete. And
how long has it been?
It's been
long
since
time.
OS X, right?
That was the transition. This is a ground. This is a ground up rewrite, or is it kind
just the graphic.
Okay.
Yeah,
but it's got to be 3-4 years or longer.
But I've heard they're just trying to basically try to take on Logic. Did you answer Logic?
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, I mean, we've been through this before. They don't have to answer to Logic because.
Because they win.
I mean, in terms of the look, I think they're definitely taking into account the way a lot of the other programs look. I mean, there's a little bit of the way Live looks in there, a little bit of even Digital Performer. Yeah. It is different. But what's cool about it is it's still easy to see. It still looks like Pro Tools, but it is different. And it also, you know, it's good because even after only seeing it for a little bit, when you go back to the way it is right now, it looks old and tired compared to what Pro Tools 8 looks like.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It's a pretty good job of doing that. But there's also a lot of stuff under the hood. It's not just that. There's full-on music notation, which is a big deal for a lot of the composers. Right. Completely integrated. So
a lot of people may not realize, yeah, that DigiDesign bought Sibelius, which is the world's most popular up-and-coming music printing software now. It's way easier to learn than Finale, which is what the high-end guys always used. And Sibelius has become a great product, and now they're integrating it into Pro Tools. And that's a really cool thing, because that was always a big stumbling block that Pro Tools couldn't print scores.
Yeah. I can't wait.
That's a feature you will.
But they've got some sound design stuff where now there is region-based pitch shifting. So the Elastic Audio, but pitch, which is very cool.
That is.
And there is automated, but there's a track comping feature now where you can actually view all of the alternate playlists for an audio track and go through them and comp up to your main playlist.
Can you see multiple
multiple lanes of automation, either above or below the audio?
Oh, really? So you can see multiples?
As many as you want.
Oh, that's nice.
And there's a bunch of updates that have to do with the control surfaces, too.
And they're also going to be including, I mean, this is where they're competing with Logic, is that they're actually going to be including a bunch of
instruments
and plugins and a lot of content and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool, but it looks really good, and it works. And also, as side effects of some of the stuff they've done, like having the notation and the multiple playlists, they've actually fixed things that you haven't been able to do, like being able to edit your 90-track session and all 6,000 of its playlists at once.
Right. Yeah, that's
well,
very
one thing.
Cool.
One thing I did hear about was good for us post guys. You can now sample accurately, tie together 5 Pro Tools systems. Mm-hmm. So, which is great. You hit play, and they all lock up. And the multiple surfaces, whether it's D control or D command, you'll be able to now control multiple Pro Tools systems within those systems.
Right.
But I just like the idea that you can synchronize not via time code, but just via Ethernet. All the systems will lock up. And for me, who uses 12 Pro Tools systems,
holy smokes,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've heard it's also the same price too as Logic. Is that right?
I heard it was free.
Video guys. Okay. No, I don't know what they're going to charge for. Did they say actually at the show?
No, I don't. I don't know. I didn't hear. I'm sure you can find it on their website if you go to digidesign.com, because I do know they have a lot of cool little videos.
It's kind of cool now for LE. And, you know,
they've expanded LE quite a bit.
64, 128.
And surround.
No, here's what you can do. Here's what you can do.
With the DV toolkit?
They have a complete production,
yeah.
And you can actually get 128 audio tracks.
Yeah.
And you can mix in 7.1. And I think that's going to
be. Ooh, 7.1. There's no format.
There's
a crowd just killer. Bam.
But the thing is I think that's the best thing about it, because of the fact that you're going to see, especially in post, you know, a lot of guys getting their, you know, their new MacBooks and their interface and doing a lot of stuff and just
and the other part which I like is now they're having for your old Macs that you can put in an HD Digi player. Basically, you get an LE system, you pop it on an old Mac, and you can run your video on it.
Well, that's cool.
Snap accurate law.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, one of your satellite machines can be just video playback.
That's
so
cool.
So now you don't have to take up the memory in the CPU overload. That's so Gallery now
and
has
you don't have to. Yeah, you don't have to buy from Gallery.
That's pretty hip.
Interesting.
But it's cool because it's all in the same network. You just download it, boom, put it there, hit play, and forget about it.
Wow. So there is going to be life for my Mac when I upgrade.
And it's on Ethernet, so you can scrub it rather than it being on time code and it's just nowhere near.
Wow. Let's see how popular Pro Tools is. Justin, have you heard of Pro Tools before?
Yeah, sure. I'm always curious, actually, the high-end Pro Tools as opposed to the LE and how Apple, you know, with Final Cut Studio and, you know, LE, how the price points and the different features, it's always kind of interesting.
In post, the problem is it's always been stereo, and stereo is kind of useless, sort of. Yeah. In post, you can do dialogue editing on it, but now that it has the 5.1 feature, it enables different price points for the post industry because it's silly to buy, you know, a 200 track system to do dialogue on.
Exactly.
Right.
That's $20,000 when, you know, you can get anything. All you need is 16 tracks.
Right. Yeah.
We've talked about it before how complicated and sometimes impossible to figure out how they figure out what features to put in the LE versions of things because they're just
only
turning
what
stuff
they have
up.
To.
Well, it's only what they have to. But
Photoshop is, of course, stripped down and
fit. Yeah.
Photoshop LE is the same thing, and it's.
But sometimes you wonder why they took out a certain thing. I mean, they obviously had a reason. But.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's a lot of places on. Like, if you go to Mix Online, they have a great blog for AES. If you want to read on some of the products that were introduced, you know, because like Korg had the new their new rack mount. Actually, their rack they have a rack mount version of their DSD.
Yeah, which is really cool stuff.
Let's see, Liquid Mix from Focusrite. That's now a TDM plugin. Which makes sense. And Sonar and Roland, I don't know if you're familiar with, they got together and now they have this new super Sonar with their hardware controller that looks like a combination, baby icon and a video switcher.
And I only get like 6 emails a day discussing their exciting new products. I've never seen a company send out so many
Sonar?
Sonar.
But it only works
with
Sonar, though.
Yeah, no. It's a joint venture between Roland and Sonar.
Did anybody see whether the Euphonics was running nicely with Pro Tools? The little MC controllers or whatever?
Well, they're Yukon. I mean, through their Yukon interface,
it's still a Huey, though.
Well, yeah, I know,
it's basically Huey, exactly.
Yeah, but there's a touch screen. You can do some really cool stuff. But I've heard it works well, but I've heard two camps. Some people use it as a doorstop because it just crashes with Pro Tools really badly, and the other one said it works fine. I've heard there were two versions that came out of hardware.
Well, there's the faders, which can run by itself, and then there's the control.
Yeah, but we tried to use it when I was in London, and it just toss it at that time. But then a couple of people said they've used it since, and they came out with a bad batch of hardware, and then
I would get the fine. Other. I would get the other version then.
I like the one that just doesn't work.
But anyhow, there's a lot of different products came out, and you can read about it online. Like I said, if you go to the Mix Online, they've got a really good blog. One thing that I did notice, though, in a general sense, and this kind of goes along with what you were talking about, Andrew, is A, it was smaller. B, you know, the large format desks are dead. I mean, you just don't see too many of them. But you see a lot of the medium size.
So I got to say, there were a ton of bizarre, flat, 1-inch thick digital desks I've never even heard of. And they had big booths and a lot of people hanging around.
Yeah, I know exactly which one you're talking about. I couldn't tell you the name of the company, but it was kind of like in the little center section.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was. Started with an M or something.
And it controlled what?
I don't know. I don't know if it was a standalone digital platform or a controller. Yeah, I don't even know.
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to.
I mean, I'm not in the market, so I didn't spend any time. Yeah. But I mean, really, like, what is that? Because there's no way that's at a $10,000 price point. I mean, this thing, it had to be an $80,000 or up console. And I have no idea. But there were a lot of interesting things. Like, Waves basically had a table, they didn't really have a booth at all.
Well,
maybe they're saving it
for
now.
At DigiDesign? At Digi? Or just?
No, just near it. But, you know, they had their own thing, but it was tiny. Marvin didn't have a booth at all. There was no Apex booth, and he's usually pretty visible at these shows.
I think a lot of these shows are still really expensive, even if they're not big, and a lot of these people just save up for NAMM because NAMM is just a couple months.
Well, one's a buying show, and the other one's a viewing show.
I think it's gotten merged. I think, though, it's gotten merged a little bit. I mean,
yeah, but you know what? For NAMM, if you're not in the inside crowd, you're not getting in.
Yeah. It's definitely difficult.
It's hard to get in.
Harder.
I will say, though, that the trend in that medium mixing desk, like the API 1608, and
that was
really cool. That
like
was
the
really
Mackie,
cool.
Right? Yeah.
The 1608 was a great. I'm totally gonna just go all API right now, but that is such a great medium little format mixing board because it takes 500 series modules and you can pretty much load it up whatever you want, and it just sounds great, and it's a perfect way to get the high end sound on your Pro Tool system, and it's, you know, for what you get, it's actually priced pretty attractively if you're in the market for a $50,000.
You totally went all API on this thing. You really did.
But on a related non-API note, like, so I went to the Tech Awards, and Rupert Neve actually won two of them. Couldn't make it, but his wife was there, which is very sweet. She's very appreciative, and it's great that, you know, one of the giants is still making products to be recognized
true.
With that.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and interestingly, API was not even nominated in a lot of the categories. So you got to sort that out. Get yourself submitted there, pal.
I'm not going to say anything political or anything
don't.
Like that.
Yeah, don't. I don't know how that process works.
It's
all.
Really political.
I'm sure it's great. Well, but hopefully the new stuff will get in there for next year.
Quiet.
Yeah. You can cut that whole thing out if you want.
Let's talk about something a lot less controversial. So, McCain, Obama.
Yeah.
Anyhow, moving on. So that was the AES show. And the best thing about AES is actually going out afterwards and having great dinners and with friends, you know, that's kind of fun. San Francisco is a great place to do the after AES thing.
I was going, but at the last minute I had to cancel everything.
Really?
Yeah, I was mixing.
Were you really?
Yeah. I was mixing
what
and
were
then
you mixing?
Literally.
Or maybe you can't say.
I can say.
Okay.
We can do it later.
We'll talk about it later. Actually, it's a good thing you're talking because I did want to bring up something really quick, and we may have to continue after the break, but
fishnets?
No, I went and saw the Express.
Ah!
The Express.
You are the only person.
Well, funny thing was, I was in the movie theater.
And it was filled with lots of people!
I was the only person in the movie theater. It was really unfortunate, but it was me, my popcorn, and my iPhone while I was taking notes.
And where did you see it?
I saw it down where I live, down in South Orange County.
Oh, you got to see it at the Bridge or the Arclight.
No, it was a big theater. It was a big theater, but I was by myself. And I was sitting down. This is a little weird because that's never happened. I mean, I've been to movies by myself before, but I've never been the only person in the movie theater.
Okay, just keep taking the salt.
Well, no. But
all day long. All week long. You're the only person.
As I'm sitting there all by myself in this giant theater, I thought, this is kind of cool. And I'm, you know, I was working on a few things on my iPhone.
A year of my life.
I know. And so then the movie starts and it goes dim and the first trailer starts playing. And then I swear I heard voices, and I'm like, this is kind of freaky because it was like a really intense movie that the trailer was. And it was like, okay, this is interesting. But actually, when the movie started, it was okay. But it was just
so. How long have you been hearing these voices?
Long time. But
I actually saw a movie. I was the only one there. I mean, this was at the end of a run for a movie, so it's nothing too depressing for the people who made it. But it was at the Arclight, and you know that they do. Like, instead of running the little trailers telling you to shut up, they actually have a guy in the theater who gives you the little spiel.
No, I didn't know
and
that.
So I'm the only one there. So he comes up and says, okay, so you're here to see blah, 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 starring blah, blah, blah. And at this point, normally, I would say don't talk, but you're the only one here, so feel free to talk to yourself. And I'll see you later.
Yeah, the best thing about going by yourself is when you, like, have your iPhone or your phone and you start texting in it and it's all bright.
No one cares.
Yeah, no one cares.
You can even let it ring.
I'm sure you
I actually
don't
yell.
Do that when
I yell.
Oh no!
I yell really loud at the screen.
Yeah, did you yell at the screen?
No, didn't yell. But yeah, I went and saw The Express, and let me tell you, it's a great movie. So I don't know why there wasn't anybody there. Oh, maybe because it was 10:30 on a Sunday evening.
Yeah, there we go.
That could be. But I wanted to talk to you about a few things on the Express. First of all, you were the. Why don't you tell people a little bit about what you did on the movie?
I was the football. No, my job was I worked with the director and came up with the full soundtrack, worked on all the dialogue, the sound effects, Foley, ADR. And basically, with a movie like The Express, it's very stylized. So it's not like see a football, hear a football, see some guys run, hear some footsteps. It was hear some footsteps, hear some horses, maybe take sound out totally, explode sounds, animals, you name it. We had trains because he was called The Express.
Right.
And we did a lot of really different things. There's about four football games within the whole movie. And instead of just making it the next football movie, just kind of a one-note movie, we shook it up a lot. And every scene had a different theme, whether it was the racism scene at night or him growing up as a kid or the cotton bowl at the very end. All this stuff's true.
Right,
and this guy is true, and I've looked at all the documents on this guy, and it's an amazing story, and I'm kind of a little sad that it hadn't done well in the box office as much, but it's a great story. I think it was a great told story, and you know they tried to make it a football movie or they tried to make it a racism movie, but what's great about it is there's a gentleman named Ernie Davis,
right,
who had to go through a lot of obstacles of life, and it's what one man, one human being can do to overcome these obstacles, and his philosophies on how to exist in a hostile environment.
I think the best thing about the movie, by the way, it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it, and the football scenes, everything. I think it just held me from beginning to the end. Even though you knew how things were going to turn out, if you knew anything about the story, it still held you. The best thing about the movie, I think, was like you were saying, is the design, and definitely how it didn't sound like your typical drama. And what I wanted to ask you is, when you approach a movie like this, you just answered that it was definitely all thought out. But what kind of challenges do you have in a drama where you can't rely on the pew pew of a science fiction, where you have to, it has to have some sense of reality because people actually know what these things sound like, as opposed to sounds where you can just make it up because they don't know what these things sound like.
Yeah. I mean, you have to look at the story and what you're trying to say. And it's kind of like, you don't want to be a rocker playing jazz and you don't want to be a jazz guy playing classical. And you want to try to figure out what is the story. It's not about us as audio people doing chops. It's about helping to tell a story and using audio as a tool to help do that. So if I'm doing like I did Valley Vella, and my biggest thing out of that movie was stay out of its way. The actors are doing an amazing job. Make sure the dialogue's heard. And if anything, or American Beauty is a similar one, stay out of the way.
Right.
Knowing when to do nothing is as hard as trying to figure out when to do something. And using negative space, not to get cliche here, but using negative space as an audio tool is a great tool of when to just play nothing. And then with Express, I've known Gary, who's the director of Gary Fleet for a long time, and he's a huge fan of JFK. So a lot of the movie was inspired by JFK. We went to 16mm black and white, all these different kind of camera techniques. And he wanted to portray it, but he didn't want it to take over the movie. He didn't want it to be schmaltzy where it's just all over the top visually. He wanted to use them as tools to help complement the story. And in audio, whether, when Ernie loses his grandpa.
Right.
And, like somebody came in the theater and said, I think you missed one of those hits against one of the tackling dummies. And like, no, we purposely didn't do that because at that point it's the emotion builds up.
Right.
And the thing is, we want to use sound as an emotional tool, not as a literal tool.
Right.
And by doing that, that's why that movie was so fun for us, is that we thought there was a lot of special stuff in it that was not literal. And not predictable.
Well, we're gonna take a break right now, and when we come back, I want to ask you just a couple specific things about the movie and how you made some of the effects. So we'll see you on the other side.
listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Ready? That whole time I really had to cough and I was like...
Go ahead and cough. We can edit it out. Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And prior to the break, I was talking with Scott here about the Express. A couple things I wanted to ask you, Scott, because when I went and saw the movie, being by myself, I know I was listening to
the movie. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was great. It was a great movie. People should go out there and see it or rent the DVD when it comes out. There's a scene at the very beginning when they're at dinner with Pops, with the grandfather, and they're eating in the background. There's a lot of trains that go in and out of different, you know, parts of the movie. But specifically...
When he's eating with Pops. By the way, that is a signature sound. Every time you hear Pops, there's a train in the background.
Ah, see, that's some of the stuff I wanted to get into. Now, was that a... Obviously, I know they wanted to put trains in there, but was it...
Conscious.
Is the director like, right there, we're going to put it right there? Is it specific?
It's like... Yeah. The directors usually are not that specific.
Okay.
It's like telling a soloist to, okay, you know, play it like this. Here's the notes I want you to play. Then what's the point? That's why you hired that person to do their thing. So, yeah, we talked about metaphors. We talked about different things. And he liked that there were trains in there. And then you found within the certain beats of dialogue where it would be more appropriate. Sometimes it's light, sometimes you're opening a scene.
Right.
Sometimes there's a big opening in a scene that you can put a sound in there that doesn't take the audience out of the drama that's happening.
Let me tell you another scene that really stood out. The dance scene, when they're in the dance scene.
There's no sound effects in these scenes. Just go ahead.
That's exactly why. It's not overdone. And the one thing I noticed in the dance scene is a lot of times when you see dance scenes on any movie, you hear a lot of foley. You hear a lot of footsteps. You hear a lot of clutter in the background. And these were really, really clean. I mean, you heard the music and you heard a little bit of utensils in the background, dishes, but mainly it was mainly dialogue and the music. And I just want to know if that was conscious. Are you conscious about, you know, trying to keep it as clean and as focused on?
I mean, it's all a contrast. And what's interesting is Mark Shaiman was the composer, did an amazing job on it. And it's trying to figure out where he's going to play, where we're going to play.
Right.
And again, it's not just see it, hear it. It's not sound for sound's sake. It's trying to get the emotional beats. It's trying to get the dialogue where it's clean.
Right.
And I call it audio focusing. It's like rack focus on a camera. You don't want to see everything. Actually, you can't see everything. You can't hear everything.
Right.
So a lot of times when my job, I believe, is to, as a sound supervisor, supervising everything, that is to make creative decisions that focus different pieces of audio at any given moment of what I want the audience to hear, whether it's dialogue and music, whether it's music only, whether it's sound effects only. I mean, in big action, even in the football scenes,
right,
we tried to make it where it was easy to listen to.
Right.
And it wasn't where it was just a barrage, stack sounds as thick as you can go, mud. You know, and it's – I came from music mixing.
Right.
And a lot of times I got a lot of compliments in my mixes by people that did amazing arrangements. If something is arranged well and the music is written well, a lot of things start coming together because the instrumentation is built in such a way where they complement each other. Same thing with movies where, you know, we had probably 600 audio tracks at any given moment on the Express. And, you know, it could become a cluster. And
might beep, come up with beep, another
a cluster beep.
It just could be a car crash of different sounds.
See, because you know what's amazing is it doesn't sound like 600 tracks, and in a good way. I mean, it doesn't. It doesn't sound that overproduced. That totally surprises me. You know, one quick question on the football.
I had 12 Pro Tools systems playing back.
Wow, that's amazing.
Maxed out. Yeah,
on the football game, the what is the sound of the football spinning? Because that's such a great sound.
Don't tell him. Don't tell him.
I mean, it's everything that you hear has been manufactured. We went out and we did the obvious thing, and that's we went out to a bunch of football teams and Canyon Country football team and all these football teams available. And also we have to make the pads sound like the 1940s, 50s, and 60s.
Right.
There's not a lot of sound. And we actually manufactured a lot of it. Actually, manufactured all of it. Used different techniques. Went out, recorded sounds. We did Foley. We smashed things together. We found things that sounded like what you think they would sound like, but they weren't those things. You know, when you take leather, you know, when you take a bunch of pads and stuff like that.
Right.
We start off with leather. I said, yeah, let's do it real. Let's take leather. That's great. But see, in real life, you don't have a music track. So what happens is you have two people hitting the leather. It's great. It sounds very organic. You pop music in. It's all gone.
Right.
So now all of a sudden, it needs something to bite. So I spent about 2 weeks doing it wrong. At the very beginning, I loved it, and I thought it was great. And then I went and went, wow, this is working.
The football hits were violent. I mean, those things sounded like just it was painful. And
at one point, because it becomes war, it no longer becomes about football. It becomes about let's get the black guy and let's hurt him. And using a combination of vocalizations as well as hitting lots of things and breaking things. We wanted to make it where if you noticed, each football game gets more violent and more aggressive sonically.
So you're not going to tell me how the spinning sound?
No.
But we
also did a lot of Doppler voices, if you noticed. We would Dopplerize crowds and then land on a racist piece of dialogue.
Right.
Did you use any of the original Meat Hit samples from the first InSonic Mirage library? Do you remember those?
That's one of the geekiest questions. Asked.
No, those were like those totally stereotypical, hits like from old bad karate movies. Yeah. It was a joke.
Yeah. Don't use those in Kill Bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
You probably did, actually.
Yeah, we did.
My favorite sound effect that you did was when...
The crickets.
Yes, no, when the coach... puts on the glasses, and you put that horn, that truck horn, at the same time that the glasses, and you used it as a transition. That was kind of cool. I really like that.
I remember that. Boy, you were, Mike really paid attention.
I was just sitting there going, wow, it's like all those smaller stuff.
Well, it's because it's a small
So you not
thing.
Only saw it by yourself, but you saw it 18 times.
No,
I thought like the night game where we dropped out all the football sounds and went slow-mo with it.
No, all that stuff was – that was great. That was all –
It's like Jurassic Park games. Going, I love the grass.
No, but I just thought that it was really kind of
The football
cool,
stuff was cool, but remember when he opened up that Coke and he poured it in the glass?
You got to see the scene if you want to know what I'm talking about. There's a scene where the coach puts on glasses – and Scott uses a transitional effect of the truck horn as he's putting on the glasses, and the next thing you see is the
did you like the flash pops?
Oh yeah, those were great.
We spent a lot of time trying to make 19 whatever flash pops that sounded We had the sizzle and the crackle
and the cool thing about where you see the flash pops, especially in the game, is you hear all this action's going on, and you just see a couple pops going on in the background of the flashes, and it's
great. We had like 20, 30 tracks for one camera.
That's crazy.
Just to get the right frequencies for, but they keep changing, so it's not a one note camera.
Yeah, and hence the 600 tracks.
So what you're saying, Mike, is see the movie and see it alone.
Exactly.
So I got a question for you.
Sure.
Just in general, with live action movies, is there any production sound ever used ever anymore?
Yes. I mean, it give you an instance on the sound effects where people have gone to the other degree, and that's in Heat. When I created the guns in Heat, what was interesting was they went out and Michael Mann wanted a certain sound of production. And the sound recordist, and there was a certain attention to detail, they wanted to get that slap that is part of the signature sound of Heat. So when those guys are shooting, there's a very key element within the gun elements that was from production. So... those types of things they do. I mean, production's role when shooting a film is to get dialogue and dialogue only. Anything else is icing. A lot of times what happens, we did it on Express, we do it in a lot of movies. While they're shooting the movie, if they've got tanks and helicopters and things they've rented, and you know, marching bands and football, we're like, well, she's got everybody there. Can we come out and spend some days, you know, behind you recording or before you? And we get to do that. But the goal of the location recordist is to get rid of every other sound other than dialogue. Because otherwise you can't control the dialogue by itself.
Yeah.
It's like having guitar tracks with the vocal, and you want to bring the vocal up, but now the guitar's coming with it.
So, well, we still deal with directors from time to time who absolutely hate ADR and want they want to get everything they can from production. And we even worked on a low-budget car movie where the cars had to be sort of a star of the film. And they ended up, luckily, they were very careful and they realized how important it was to get some of these cars. And it wasn't on top of dialogue, but they were careful to get some really great car recordings when they were shooting the film. And it made our job easier to not have to recreate these things, because when you have something like cars doing very intricate maneuvers and you have to match that sound perfectly, it can be done, but it's a lot of work. If you can actually get that in production, which is definitely what this director wanted, it's good.
And then there's the art of trying to get sounds like in Black Hawk Down. We wanted sounds to be very organic and almost like poppy, like real gunfire rather than Hollywood guns. So you can do a lot of that, or in Herbie, where I had access to a whole NASCAR setup. Right. So, you know, I had 2 days over at the LA Speedway. If I've got access to NASCARs, I'm going to record them.
Well, yeah, I would just say people go see The Express. Great movie. Sounds good. Scott, you did a great job, but you don't need me to tell you that because you know you did. You always do a good job.
Okay, two people.
That's the good thing about knowing Scott.
We will pay you to see the movie.
It gives you an excuse to go out and see movies and, you know, tell my wife, yeah, I got to do some research, so I'll be back in a couple hours. Justin.
Yep.
You still here?
You still with us?
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. As an effects guy, when you're creating your backgrounds or your plates or working in the environment, and Hez, you can also, you know, comment on this. Are you ever blown away by, you know, is it ever what you hear in the movie theater just totally different from what you were thinking it was going to sound like, or do you not even care what it's
going
to sound?
Yeah, it's interesting because just listening to Scott, there's a number of moments when you're describing process, and probably two or three times I was about to say, yeah, I'm thinking like that guy, because you're literally talking through process and working in effects. Even the last part when you were speaking about you know, being on set, and you know, when we shoot visual effects plates, we're doing clean plates without actors, so we're doing, you know, different passes with you know, to get, well, if it's motion control, you know, we're doing these different passes to get clean plates so we can do all of our other, you know, effects work on top. So it's not unlike the audio world, you know, and with visual, and it's interesting to hear the different parallels between, you know, the process and how you're going through and what you're going through creatively in these shots. It's we're kind of going through a similar process when we're trying to generate these visuals within the film. And that's either, you know, with animation as well as visual effects, it seems like when you think about environments and how the environments are really, you know, the director has really specific, you know, ideas in the production designer about how they want to focus in the environment on a character, on a particular beat or a particular moment. So, you know, all that kind of stuff's taken into consideration, and it can be down to the, you know, minute details of certain elements or the painting or miniatures or CG or whatever to kind of accomplish that.
Right.
So it's interesting how it's a similar.
Yeah, I was really blown away by the fact that a couple of days ago I just happened to be in the theater waiting for some people to get done looking at something, and they had the sound designer there. And they were looking at a sequence that I did the camera work on. And can't give any of it away right now because the movie's not out yet. But basically, the directors were in there, and they were like, oh, well, you know, it's in this scene, and blah, blah, blah. And we really need this effect, this sound effect. And, you know, it's an obvious kind of thing, but I sat there, and the sound designer was like, you know, yeah, but you know, we're really waiting for this, this, and this, and this. And when he said that, my eyes lit up like this, and I turned one of my colleagues, and looked at him like, oh my God, that's exactly what we were talking about when we were putting this together in the first place. And it was really cool and very kind of reassuring to hear someone who isn't a visual person per se to come in with that part of the process at the end saying, oh, no, 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 and they got it. Even if they, you know, didn't really get it, you know, directly, they actually sat there and it made sense to them and it clicked. Yeah. So the process is exactly the same. And, you know, we're constantly sitting there when you're dealing with camera early on all the way through to the very end, even after lighting. Sometimes we have to go back and change some things and then they have to re-render.
Cameras change all the time.
Yeah, we're you know, I think 185 iterations is the record right now on our show. So
a little different
on one shot.
A little different on a live action set. I don't think they have quite that attitude.
So when you're talking camera, we're talking digital camera.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But we also use we're using an InterSense camera rig now, which allows us to basically shoot the scene digitally, and then literally we've got a harness, and you put on a Steadicam rig, and you're watching it on a big plasma screen, and you'll sit there and you'll move around.
Wow. So it's simulating.
You're layering.
So you're doing real-time camera moves.
That's like virtual reality. That's like
it is.
The glasses is with the hands.
Exactly.
Because I did cinematics in Gears of War, and what was interesting was they go, oh, well, everything's locked. And it's interesting to see their perspective because what wasn't locked were the camera moves.
Right.
Yeah. So everybody was there and they're going, oh, it's, you know, the person's walking. Well, one's a wide shot. The other one's, they changed it to like a wraparound shot. And then I got a back shot. And it's the same thing. And I would, and the difference is how I handle audio is totally different.
Right.
But the sync is the same. But as we keep getting to different versions, it's interesting to see what's changing are the camera moves.
Right. And the big struggle for us, especially now that we're starting to incorporate more of this technology and we're doing stereo and everything, is what's the language? And we're trying to take the language of movies from a, like, look, you know, here's the two-thirds rule. You know, here's, you know, negative space versus, you know, all this and other stuff. And composing like you would, say, Bambi or Snow White, which is considered like one of the most amazingly, or Sleeping Beauty, one of the most amazingly composed films ever for animation. And so now all of a sudden we have to kind of incorporate these new technologies and you can't use exactly the same rules.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily cut a lot. You can't necessarily move around a lot.
You start
or whatever.
Doing shaky cameras, you get serious headaches with stereo.
Right.
So it's a different set of rules.
The movie I'm on now, which I don't know if I can name, but I'm on a movie now that there's like 100 cuts per 10 seconds. You know, so it's incredibly frantic. And when you see, because they go through these raves and it's very action and some of it's very violent and it you've got to learn how to phrase the visual. Because what happens is there's so much visually happening that you have no clue what you're seeing.
Right.
So you literally have to go in slow-mo and go, okay, I can stop there. There's a phrase. There's a stop. Beat, beat, beat. And then what you do is you actually start building the audio realm to have it make sense of what you're visually seeing. Another good version, a buddy of mine, one of the guys at the company did, Born in Ultimatum. And it was in a similar situation. Where Bourne was so chaotic visually that the sound had to help define what you were visually seeing.
Right.
Same thing with this movie I'm doing now, but it's even more intense.
Do you ever get the soundtrack? It's because you have to do specific camera moves or specific shots?
Yeah, we get a temp track and temp dialogue to start out with. They're always constantly, you know, wrestling with actors' schedules to get them in to record.
Right.
But again, you know, the process is so long that, you know, you get all these iterations on these shots and everything. That
I guess they'll spend 3 to 4 years.
No, it's changed a lot. Actually, it's a lot more aggressive now. I think it's minus – it's a year and a half now.
Wow.
No,
it's very different. I mean, in live action effects, it's a very different world than animation. I mean, we're working on a show and we've got whatever 50 or 100 shots or whatever we're doing, I would never see any kind of audio.
You know,
daily I'd go and look at the paintings on screen and we'd be previewing, you know, the footage, making sure things are blending where they need to blend and you know, you're building your environments and you're kind of looking at it and see how things hook up and then, you know, the director would then come in and look at it and see progress. But you know, it very, very rarely ever have anything to do with audio. We'd always be looking at silent.
Well, I think we have some movies that we've done together on Tarzan. Mm-hmm. I think we gave you guys a whole bunch of background jungle backgrounds and stuff for you guys to do backgrounds against. Did you? Can we get that stuff?
Somebody said,
oh, it's great. We gave the artists all these backgrounds and they came up with some ideas.
I was just actually going to say that on live action, one of the problems I think for animation is that there's this handoff that happens way later. Yeah. The editors that are on campus are the ones that are throwing in these temp sounds.
Yeah.
And so then that's, of course, affecting when these iterations come through what we do next. Oh, hey, there's a really big car crash sound there. So maybe that changes the way you perceive things.
Let's change the camera.
Again. And then at the end, when it gets through like 75% lighting or whatever, then they call someone like you guys in. And then it's, oh, okay. And so you're kind of being handed something pseudo-baked.
Now, yeah, it's interesting because I know you guys are doing work with DreamWorks, and I was hired years ago on a movie called Spirit.
Yep.
And what my job was to help understand the audio language of horses. So they flew me to Fresno, and I was trying to figure out how to record horses in their natural environment. And I saw opera shows, and they put the microphone right above between their eyes when they sing, and I thought that was really cool. So I went and did that to horses. So I put radio mics on 8 different horses, and I put them on the hoof, their stomach to get the hoofs, and then right on their head. And then they just went out into the pasture, had my little car set up with all the radio mics and multiple recorders to record horses in their natural environment. And it was kind of a fascinating case study, and I got a chance to see how they were trying to put Spirit together. You know, and they were like, let's try that, especially with Jeffrey. Yeah. You know, it's like, let's try this. And the whole, it's just new for me, all the walls to the hallway were all storyboards. The whole floor was storyboards.
Yeah.
And they walked me through the offices going in this, and then now what's going on in this
hallway. Seems to be a lot more spelled out than, I mean, live action effects, we'd get, you know, a chicken scrawl, you know, thumbnail. And they'd say, you know, this is our establishing match shot for, you know, Castle Dracula and Van Helsing. And then we'd proceed to, you know, design the whole castle and do these big pullbacks. And it's very different. I mean, it's the schedule is much more compressed, yet many times you're not really given as much. But, you know, being on a set, you don't have the time, you know, to do this.
Are you also doing a lot of background extensions where, you know, like, I know, like in Gladiator, they just built the whole Colosseum.
Right. Yeah, all built out.
Yeah. That's amazing stuff.
You know, it's amazing as I'm sitting here listening to you guys talk. It's so weird how...
It's so boring.
No, it isn't. It's kind of fascinating because it's the two different disciplines that are on opposite sides of the film, and yet they, you know, the process is the same.
The process is real similar.
Very similar.
What I find really interesting, too, is the restrictions that you have. The different disciplines are going to have certain restrictions. And you know, like Hez was mentioning, in animation and live action, it's interesting where the restrictions, where you hit the wall.
Right.
Many times it's, okay, whatever department is kind of hitting that wall, that's kind of where your playtime has to end. And with us in the mat department, we're building these shots and doing our, you know, CG projections and geometry and projecting these paintings, and we're building these worlds around a limited camera move.
Yeah.
So, you know, on a live action set, you build the set out, you know, 3/4, and then the camera can move to here, and then that's enough. But, you know, in animation, it's like, well, we changed our mind. We want to move the camera around the set, and then, okay, well, then it comes back to us, and now we've got to build it back out. It can all be done, but you're kind of bound by the limitations of what you're doing. It doesn't matter if it's real life on a live action set or CG. It's as long as the director, they have an understanding of what they're asking for. Because we can do anything. It's just a matter of, well, okay, we can do that, but now that's going to take another 3-4 weeks to build this out.
Like, I don't know if you realize when you saw Express, the stadium only had 100 people in it.
Oh, no. I figured any large crowd scene nowadays.
And not only that, but that stadium in Syracuse doesn't exist anymore, so they rebuilt the stadium and populated it with people. and there were only 100. You know, so when you see the close-ups,
right.
It's like 100 people, and everybody else in the stadium is manufactured originally.
Did they have any of those fake people that they blow up?
You know, no. The little cardboard cutouts?
Well, anyhow, I don't know about you guys, but were you going to say something?
Well, I just had a question, because when you're talking about composing the movie, I mean, doing it with animation, but in the record business, there was a very quick transition once digital technology happened, and then a really quick transition when it all moved onto computers instead of onto tape. And so now it's been going on long enough in this completely different medium where there's a whole generation of people making records that have never worked on tape. And for all the guys who are around who worked on tape, it's always this thing, they don't know how to make records, right? I mean,
same thing with us,
and,
by the way.
Well, yeah. And that's what I was going to ask, is how much of like the classic filmmaking technique that has nothing to do with the technology you're using is prevalent or needed? Or
it's needed, but there's something esoteric about it. When you think about people coming out of school now, we talk about this all the time in our department, is that the way students are educated now, there's a huge emphasis on learning the software, because you know, you want to get out of school and you have to drive the software. So you know, you have guys coming out that are great at Maya and they're Photoshop whizzes and they're great in 3D, but you know, you simply don't have the time when you're in school to necessarily study the art. And you know, of course, way back when I was in school, because I'm really old, I'm 41 now. So,
And
did you drive yourself here?
Right. Yeah, I drove myself.
Are you tired? Do you want to get out?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, because I started doing this on glass, right? So, you know, most people don't really know what, you know, matte painting on glass is. So, when I train mixing oil paint and putting it on glass and then it appears in a motion picture, people just don't, they're thinking, of course, Photoshop now. But the techniques and the art behind what we're doing, even in animation, it all stems from, you know, classic painting and classic mixing paint and dealing with color. And many times when I was at Illusion Arts, there's a number of films where we went to Universal when they had different visual effects groups working on the lot, and we were called in, just two of us, to go in there and look at these things and try and help out why things weren't working. In many instances, it was because, you know, simple visual art cues were not being adhered to, and it makes you wonder, you know, these weren't super technical reasons why the shot isn't working. And the director knows something's wrong. The art director knows something's wrong. But they don't know the reason why. And just like in sound, if you've been trained and you have a tuned ear to something, it's going to be very obvious. Well, of course, it's not working because you got a tangent. The cloud's lining up with this tree, and it looks like this flat thing, and it's not animating the way it needs. And, you know, you develop these, you know, these visuals where you can, it becomes very clear. Yeah, just get rid of that cloud, and it should work. And all of a sudden, it works. But it's not a magic formula. It's just, it's the classic
art.
It's the classic art training that many times is missing.
What do you think about, like, in video games, between both backgrounds and camera work? I've been doing video games for 17 years, also in conjunction with movies. But what I've noticed in the last, let's say, 5-7 years, is that video games always had kind of a one-dimensional look. There wasn't that out-of-focus, slight, softer. It's just animation in general, but in video games has been pretty prevalent. How much it's grown, even in the last 3 years, where it's now starting to get... It's
Gears of War.
Yeah, it's competed against... It's amazing. I think it's blown away most TV, and now it's biting the heels of movies.
Well, I will... I'll say that I think it actually kind of to bridge what you were asking about, you know... just a real quick kind of background with me, I have a very different perspective because I came to California originally as a musician, and I had no background in animation whatsoever. And I had hung out in recording studios a little bit because I went to school and, you know, there were guys that had keys and we'd go in there and screw around. But when I came out here, it was pretty clear that being a musician was not going to work for me. And I still love music, and I still do music on my own, and I've got Logic, and I've got Ableton, and all these different things. And
what do you play?
I'm a drummer, but I actually minored in harpsichord, so
Wow. Nice.
MIDI bits.
Yeah. Very cool, but so, we understand why you realized that.
Well, right. no one wanted a Keith Emerson anymore, so, you know. Anyway.
Tour with one of those.
So showed up here, and the first, you know, the people that I knew back home knew some people out here who happened to work at Disney on Dinosaur, and that's how I got into this. So I had actually dealt with tape, and I had dealt with both computers and tape before I came out here. And then all of a sudden I got in here and they sat me down at an SGI, a Silicon Graphics machine, and said, look, make it work. And I was like pretty computer literate anyway, but I was blown away because this is Disney. And all the stuff on the walls was all 2D. And they were doing this 3D movie called Dinosaur. And right next door they were doing Mulan. And I was very confused and went around and asked a lot of people what was going on, and there were a lot of very nervous people, to be honest. And I think it's actually taken a lot longer for the analog to 3D switch.
In animation.
Yeah.
Non-live action. Yeah.
But in games, that's solely what it's about. And I had a small stint in games early on, and I saw immediately that...
At Disney? Or
No, this was at a small company out in San Dimas, okay. And it's no longer there. But it was one of the original guys from Atari that had started this little boutique shop. So anyway, you know, immediately I got involved with some people who were doing that went on to NVIDIA, and now they have these cards that they can put in these machines, and they're able to render things real time that take us sometimes 3 and 6 hours to render. Now, granted, the quality is arguably better, different, whatever you want to say about it. When you put it on your PS3 or your Xbox and you play the game and you see the cinematics or even the in-game play, the art direction for Gears of War is insane.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And the lighting is beautiful. Yeah. And so they've been able to just kind of skyrocket. And so now there's this kind of, well, technology-wise, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, there's this stuff that we could take advantage of, but now it's kind of like the same nervousness when I first started at Disney.
Well, it's stereoscopic now, right?
So it's all about stereo and everything, but that nervousness is sort of like, oh, gosh, you know, what's going to happen now? You know, there's this whole game thing, and are a bunch of gamers going to come in here and take our jobs away from us? You know, you know, so, you know, not everybody obviously is like that, and it's not a reality from a practical standpoint, But
you know, I'm seeing a lot of transition though. That at one point I was offered a position at EA up in Redwood Shores. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is they're like, oh, these guys are from PDI and Pixar, and mm-hmm. And what's happening is I think it's becoming another outlet for employment where it's not like gamers against film guys; it's people jumping back and forth to work on those kinds of projects.
Absolutely. I mean, the transition was at Disney through the 90s, and you know that transition happened with, you know, purchasing a DreamQuest, and there was a big transition with the digital people coming through, and a lot of the 2D people, and I remember the days when I'd picking up Photoshop in 92, and people looking at me like, well, why do you want to learn Photoshop? Don't you want to be an artist? I mean, don't you like painting? And I'm like, well, yeah, but you know, can't we use this? And then it took maybe 5-6 years later, all of a sudden people are starting to take a look at it. But there was a real slow, I don't know why that happened in animation, but there was a really slow, it was a slow climb.
There was a lot of resistance, I think. I mean, when I first started at DreamWorks, I remember sitting in the effects department, and they had one guy who was in charge of the 3D section and one guy in charge of the 2D section. And they got along great, but there was always this kind of, you know, well, can you draw? No. Well, see you later, you know, kind of thing. And now it's, you know, like Justin was saying, you know, things have changed a lot where a lot of these kids are coming out of these programs, and it's not unlike maybe some of the programs for like Expression or Full Sail where a lot of these kids may be coming out and maybe they've sat at a 64-channel console and, you know, they know something about all that. But just, you know, they know Pro Tools, but does that mean that they have an ear?
It's the problem. Right. So, and Mike and I, we've talked about this, about the ability to problem solve artistically is huge. And it's a far cry from knowing software and be able to drive software. And that's the biggest.
What's like music? Just because you get good sounds doesn't mean you do good music.
Right.
Well, there's no substitute for knowing taste. Taste and also where. I mean, the technology is a simulation of the way people used to do things. There's not too much in technology that isn't rooted in the way things used to be done.
Right.
I mean, there's some, but it's mostly, you know, a modern simulation of the way things used to be done. And it's much more efficient and much easier and much quicker, and it sped up, you know, deadlines and everything else. But to understand the way it used to be done is just going to make you better at using the new technology.
That's hard sometimes to convince.
It's really hard. We've had that conversation.
That's necessary. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we've had that conversation about tools or technique. And
the technical threshold to even start is so high now that, right. I mean, it's a huge amount of training. You have to have it or you can't even work.
Right.
So once you get there, it's like, well,
how do you set yourself apart?
Yeah.
You know what's amazing is, you know, the parallel between the visual and the audio, where you have the digital with the digital acquisition of the image. And then you also have analog, because some people still shoot film. And same thing on the audio side. You've got the HD hard disk recorders, and then you've got the people who still do
Definitely parallel, but their toys are a lot more expensive than ours.
Yeah. and they get more time and money.
Well, I don't know, though.
I've never been on a film where I go, you know what? I need 4 more weeks. And they go, no. Yeah. All of a sudden, the visual effects, you know, we're 4 weeks behind the visuals. We'll extend.
Well, that's true, too.
In a heartbeat.
But I will tell you that there are, you know, you've got open source tools. You've got different Blender, which is a 3D program mm-hmm. that people have done some stuff with. You've got Lightwave has come down in price. All the big packages have come down in price.
Yeah, we were talking about Maya before.
I think the price of entry, like, I would love to be able to have a D control or an icon at home, but, you know, I don't have $110,000.
By the way, I just bought a D command. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
No, but you know what? But the
lucky you.
The similarity in audio, though, is you've got Pro Tools LE. So I think the tools, you know, entry at both sides can be approachable. It's the mastering that's of those tools.
Right.
That takes a lifetime.
The big difference too. Early on, of course, everyone has a pencil. Right.
Yeah.
Everybody can actually go into the art store and buy some paint with a brush, and you know, when I started at Disney, literally that there you had brushes and some oil paint, and then the cameraman would come in at the end of the day, take the painting off the shelf and shoot it, and then you'd see it on screen the next day. But you know, it's bizarre to think that that's your tool, you know, a brush and some paint. But things tended to equal out with Photoshop and with the birth of these digital tools, and that's kind of. Sadly, that's kind of management really enjoyed the fact that, you know, digital now. So that means anybody can do that, right?
So I actually have a question for you guys. I mean, do you think that, like, I know that our tool sets change, like, every 6 months there's a new video card or there's a new whatever, and there's always new versions of all this software coming out, new plugins, all this kind of stuff. And I was hearing you guys talk earlier about how at AES, like, Waves has got this new thing, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, there's one more plug-in. Do things change too soon, not enough? Is it kind of overwhelming and just sort of a wash, and you just have to say, you know what, I have to just be educated and make a decision about what the tools I'm going to use and limit my palette?
I would have to say it used to be a little more overwhelming that way. Yeah. I think a lot of the crazy ideas have been shaken out, and it seems more manageable now.
Yeah, it's a pretty mature thing now in audio. And the other thing is that, at least with records, I mean, cause that's what I know. You can make a record with any vintage version of the tools, and the product you're going to come out with is going to be the same. Whereas I think you guys are hampered, where if you're doing something, a digital animation of some description, you've got to be using the latest tools, or it's going to look like you're not in a lot of cases.
But see, that's the same thing with sound design.
Not that you can't. I mean, I'm not saying from the artistic point of view, but in terms of just how complex it's going
to
be.
And, no, it's true. If you want to animate water, it's going to be tough to do with, you know, Strata.
So. Right.
But see,
right.
What's interesting, I think, on the sound equivalent, is the moment you guys come up with something visually different, we got to put a sound that's sonically different. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I get joked around because I have lots of outboard gear and lots of plugins. I have to, because I need to take something that starts organic or something that's somewhat familiar and put a different spin on it, either through hyper reality or something that's just totally different. Like, we just got finished recording alligators in Florida and walruses in San Francisco. We went with the big animal. We're still doing it because we need more creatures. We're kind of out of elements, so we need to go out and capture more different, unique things.
So how much of it is collage versus
synthetic?
Synthetic, yeah.
Most of it's collage. I mean, okay. Synthetic has a certain sound to it, but you can manipulate things. Again, it's starting off with something somewhat organic.
I was
going to
say, that's exactly what we do in effects. I mean, on the movie, the score, you know, in the parking lot, you know, we had a huge, you know, where the safe explodes in the film. We're out in the parking lot using, you know, fire hoses and generating plate, you know, recording plates with high-speed cameras of water, and then getting a fish tank and sticking firecrackers in it and shoot another high-speed camera, you know, and building these elements. And it's the same thing with Folly.
I think the parallels, too, with technology is they're pretty even, though, because even though the main tools are pretty established, you got plugins that come in all the time. And,
right.
and there's, you know, if you're in electronica or dance and you want to have the latest, greatest sound, it's like if you're in, working on Lightwave or working in Maya and someone comes up with a great, you know, UV mapping tool or something, you know, where you got to have that. And, you know, it's the same kind of progression, you know, when you've started off with 3D and next thing, you know, you start with polygon modeling and then, hey, look, I can work with faces. Oh, I can work with, you know, edges here. And then, hey, we got bump mapping and we've got, you know, radiosity lighting. It's been the same
thing. It's usually driven by a need that isn't
exactly.
there.
Yeah.
And it's also very much by genre. I mean, to be fair, in the music thing, I mean, I'm thinking guitar bands. So, okay, whatever. Go get a couple of mics and some tape and you can still do it. And Woody Allen can still make a movie with just a camera and a couple mics and be fine.
But I think, you know, what's different is I think trade-off with technology, though, is convenience versus quality. Because I find what's happened over the last at least decade is it may not sound as good, even with the plugins. Do you go out and buy the vintage gear, try it, hopefully it's in good shape, keep it going, or do you buy a model of it, which may not be quite as good, but it's very convenient.
Well, also vintage.
But in post-production, where we don't have time as a very defined piece,
right.
all of a sudden we've given up occasionally a little bit of quality because all of a sudden, like right now there's a big debate going on, and I'm going back and forth because I'm doing a lot more mixing. Do I do everything virtual, where I have all the plugins, where I call it up, and I can redo it every single time, or do I start using a lot more of my outboard gear? And I'm doing a mix right now, and I've gone both because I've actually maxed out everything you can do on a Pro Tools. So I'm starting to use outboard gear to be able to weigh both of them.
Right.
But it is nice to be able to call up a session 2 years later, boom, the plugins work, everything's there.
The key is does the producer care? And my experience
with
is...
With theaters sounding like the way they do?
Yeah, but the big thing is...
That's what they do.
With effects, the big key is, well... That is good enough. We like it. This is working, and it's simply good enough. And to my eye, many times I'm like, I cannot believe they just said final to that. I mean,
right.
that's it's amazing. And yet it's good enough.
Yeah.
So the producers, you know, they have their own eye, they have their own agenda, and if they don't want to spend any more money, it's done. And I looking at something, thinking that needs another 2 weeks worth of work, and I'm like, nah, it's good. It's good.
You know what? A successful producer knows when things are good enough. I mean, in any field, it's.
Yep.
Probably the hardest call to make, but it's most important.
Yeah.
Well, hey, guys, we're going long here. So we're going
into hour two now?
All right. Run, Ernie, run!
Sorry, flashback.
We're going to have to start wrapping it up, but that's a good place to end in the fact that on both sides, we both hate the clients. So there you go.
Nice.
The ultimate common bond.
And none of us will ever work again.
Oh, good.
I don't know about you guys.
Let's go to the pub.
I don't know about you guys, but I felt like this was like the UN, and we brought audio and visuals together. So, hey, thanks, guys, for joining us.
That's great.
It's really interesting.
Thank you very much.
It's really, really interesting to see the parallels.
It's somewhat reassuring to me.
Yeah.
Actually, you know.
It's kind of odd that you just don't see the audio and visual come together, and it is bizarre to see how many parallels
there are. Well, any project, I mean, that's one thing, as you guys describe, I mean, and from the sound point of view, on films, there's so many people involved. Like on a record, usually everybody who's worked on the record has been in the room at the same time at some point. And it never, ever, ever, ever happens on a film. And you've got people working on sound. Like you're saying, the guys doing your temp score have no idea what the final's going to be.
At least the big Disney parties.
That's it. It just gets passed on. So it's... It's bizarre.
Well, we're going to have you come back again another time when that technology has made the next leap.
in about 8 hours.
So before we go, Rob, are you working on anything you can talk about? Or?
Yeah, not by name, but actually we're in the process starting tomorrow. We're going to be recording a bunch of ADR for a film, which should be a lot of fun. Actually, some actual stars. Unlike when we've usually done it for low-budget films, this it should be interesting because these are going to be people who are used to doing ADR, and we're hoping it'll go quick because there's a huge amount to record. And this is just
10 lines an hour. I'm serious, 10, 15 lines an hour.
Yeah, we'll do better than 10. I'm hoping 15. But after this week, this is like a temporary diversion, and then we're actually in the middle of doing two albums right now.
Wow.
With new artists. One is sort of a punk pop band, and the other is sort of a funk jazz album. And these are projects I'm going to be able to start talking about more in the next few weeks.
Great. Looking forward to that. Andrew?
Well, I think last time I was actually here, the Metallica record had not come out yet. And it did, and it was number one in 24 countries or something. And I think I heard some sort of controversy about, I don't know, there might have been some chit-chat about how it sounded or whatever.
Sounds great.
But, yeah, so at the moment, just working on a couple little things. And the biggest news is we've just completed my son's first college application for early decision for Yale. So we'll find
Yale!
Out.
Yeah. Andrew is available. For okay. mixing.
and I feel old.
Yale School of Music?
Andrew's looking Andrew's looking for projects.
It's a way to
mix,
simultaneously make you feel old and poor.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And Scott, I know you're mixing a film you can't talk about.
Actually, you know, I think I was just thinking about it. Actually, it's out there, so I guess I could. I guess I could publicize both of them. Movie right now, I'm actually doing two movies with the same directors. They shot two movies. So one of them is a movie called Game, and the other one is Crank 2. And these guys are great, and it's a very different kind of movie than I've ever done, and it's quite fun. And I've actually mixed the Temtub, which we're playing in the theater on Wednesday. So we did all in my room, and it was all virtual because they kept changing picture.
Mm-hmm.
And audio check, and we kept changing the mix for the last 3 weeks. So we've been putting in 16-hour days, and literally, I just an hour before I could hear, I delivered the last reel that's now being transferred to, I guess, DigiBeta, whatever.
Wow. V5. Well, good thing you finished on time so you could make the podcast.
Yeah,
and as Bobby would say, what are you working on, Mike?
I'm in the middle of working on a couple commercials for some pretty big DVD releases, and I'm in hell, you know. And I'll just tell you that right off the bat, because it's clients changing, and changing. So, you know, we're talking 14 to 16-hour days, and it's just, it's ugly.
So,
but you know what?
So we'll do Baja Fresh at night together, right?
Yeah, but the thing is with the economy and the environment, you know, as much as I don't like the long hours and stuff, it's, you gotta be thankful you've got a gig.
That's right.
And are you guys working on anything you're allowed to talk about?
I think so. I mean, we'll plug it. Monsters vs. Aliens.
Yeah. Oh, great.
We're finishing that.
Yeah, it's coming out, I guess, was that March?
Yeah.
Yeah,
very soon.
Did either one of you work on Madagascar too?
I didn't. No, I didn't.
That was done. That was up north.
It looks funny.
That was up north.
Yeah,
it does.
PDI.
I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot, Justin. Thanks a lot, Hez.
You bet. Thank you.
We appreciate you coming down and talking, and it was really interesting. And if you want to contact us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. If you have any comments or questions or even just want to come by and sit in on the show and you're in the Southern California area, feel free to drop us a line. You can also check out our MySpace. What was that? You can also check out our MySpace page. It's myspace.com/audionowcast. All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield.
The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel voice processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.